It's remarkable to win an award of any kind, of course, and I was just thrilled to hear about this. But more remarkable still, for it to be an award associated with a poet I admire as much as Larry Levis. And just to have my name associated with him is a very special thing. And thank you all. Thank all of you who worked on the prize, those of you who have supported this in the past, and everyone else. And thank you all for coming. I'm going to read some poems from the book and then some new poems. And the poems from the book will just be sort of a sampling of the sort of the overall architecture of it, I hope. The book primarily, well, I guess basically the lens that I have sort of seen through in the past many years was one that was created by the fact that my mother's hometown of Friendship, Texas, was flooded in the mid-70s in order to protect the poorer towns south along the San Gabriel River. And it was sort of an odd community. It's a place where I spent summers as a kid. They were all Czech farmers. They still spoke Czech and did everything Czech, sang Czech, drank Czech, ate Czech. Everything was Czech. And yet you're right in the middle of Texas with the pickup trucks and the boots and the big hats. And then one day, basically, when I was a teenager, it was a lake and the loss of that. So anyway, I say that in part just as sometimes there are water images that might not make much sense in the poems unless you know that fact. But the first poem I'll read is called The Joke. And my son, Doc, who's here, came home from first grade with a good one, which he repeated over and over and over again. It's rare that they're good ones, by the way. But thanks, Doc, for this. The Joke. The skeleton, my son says, can't cross the road because it doesn't have the guts. See, I told you. Which explains, perhaps, why it's still at the edge of our yard, looking out across the road into the dark. I'm just kidding. You see, it's us by the roadside. Our bones, the wind whistles. And the darkness beyond, that's ours also. Doesn't turn out so funny, really, does it? I always try to start off funny. I was out in California back in January and experienced something I'd never experienced in the very uptight Cambridge where I live. And these people just started talking to me during the reading, often in the middle of poems, but that was a little weird. But in between poems, and it was just sort of this rapping that went on. And there's something about it that I just loved in terms of breaking down the barriers of this. And it's going to be difficult since there's this weird space. But you know, if you want to heckle, whatever, please jump in. This poem is called Maybe Night Comes. Sunrise over the fields shapes the cotton we call cash crop, king, snowballs in hell. Words that hint its hand-shredding truth. It's nighttime fellowship with earth we eat, rain we drink, earth we all bloom into. Ours is the daylight world. The dead must stay in the ground and out of the cotton all day. Defined, holdable, cotton is king. Its promise to rule without whimsy, without contradiction. But night comes like water to obliterate and enlarge, so that words for me, David, child, husband, lover, father, dissolve or spread like seeds over an earth where my stillborn brother, also David, echoes my daily failures with his more ultimate one. At night, when I cannot see myself, I see him testing an electric fence with a blade of grass, or answering my living brother when he calls our name. Maybe night comes then to give us what we cannot bear to see, brooding over sun-cracked fields, David, stillborn, father, name. There's some cheery ones in here someplace, I promise. The beauty of America, and perhaps of all of the world, is that no matter how low you are on the social totem pole, like the Czechs were very low, there's always at least somebody below you to kick around. And in the case of my grandparents in the farm there, it was the Mexicans, typically, who were known there as the wetbacks, and that's the word I use here. And this is the story of one of them. Once the Friendship was flooded, they had to remove all of the bodies from the cemeteries. And so here's my imagining this one man who worked for my grandfather coming back to come get all the Mexicans himself. It's called Mr. Swetner's Parade. Mr. Swetner puts his cart before his snow-eyed mule and pulls them down the field roads of Friendship, Texas, dragging cans. "Wake up," he cries, "let's get on with it." These were the words my grandfather used to rouse him and the other Mexicans who lived in the wetback shed across the cattle guard. Long ago, Mr. Swetner's son fell from a tractor and was baled with the maize. And a year later, his wife and child died in childbirth. On that night, he hammered his 65 chinchillas to death and left their skinned bodies in a pile alive with green flies. So if he's now come back to gather the dead Mexicans and only them, we ought to forgive his insolence, because there is no guilt here, and rather follow to where he takes the dead ones, someplace still not owned, but forever theirs. Something about that poem makes me want to tell you, don't start a union unless you really have to. This one's called Uncle Emmett, Wiser Than God. The most nearly spherical and therefore perfect of seven brothers and his beautiful butcher wife, Mary, brought forth no children unto this land, which now is water. They seemed to know the dam would come and all return to darkness, that God would rest from then on and say of Friendship, Texas, I did what I could do. Emmett laughed as they walked into their fields, as the water rose to their heads, as Mary nuzzled his stone-smelling neck, and he said of Friendship, Texas, it never had a chance, which they'd known since tasting the wheat in the body of Christ, since Mary first split open a rabbit and touched her fingers to her tongue. So they decided not to fight their destiny, the dam's brown water of forgetting, but rather to take it in, to swell and dissolve like seeds, to wander into the heart of that more perfect solitude. And so, hand in hand and slow, they did. I sort of pull out of Friendship for a while for a couple of prose poems that are in the middle of the book. This is called Paint. White, he said, I'm going to paint everything white. Good, she said, it's about time. It's time to paint everything white. Yes, he said, and he pulled out a large brush and painted the words everything and white on the wall in a very attractive hand, words which happened to be the first two of the novel he'd just begun writing of the same name. She was not amused. I'm not amused, she said. Paint. This place is filthy. He painted the words was kept in a separate room across the wall and onto the window. Then, until the snow fell and it was taken outside, which is when they met. And on, until the walls were filled and the floor, the plants, the couch, the lights, the pages of books, the words, the chapters becoming indistinguishable. She said, the place looks great. You're a good painter. Thanks, he said. And he took off his clothes to begin the last chapter on his legs. It was a love story, but also a mystery, because it turns out the two lovers had been dead all along. Dead people can't be characters, she said. It's not right. And she took off her shirt and pants and said, paint, it can't end like this. Of course, it could end any way he wanted. So he kissed her as he painted yes over and over until she disappeared. It's another, starts out funny, gets sad, right? It's like life. Yeah, I grew up in Tennessee mostly, outside of Nashville, in a little town called Murfreesboro, and I'm happy to be back in a place where I can say, you all know what the phrase good people means. Growing up, it was a phrase that was everywhere, and it was code, of course. It meant that you all belonged to the same clubs and hated the same groups of other people. And so this is a poem about what called good people. The woman to my left is screaming. She is screaming everything there is to scream about scream. At once, she screams entire and infinite vocabulary. Simultaneous God and mouse scream, lottery winning, first gray hair, death in the family, stars wheeling westward, hard frightening sex scream. And she is, in her way, handsome. She is likable. Our mothers would say she is from good people, meaning she's like us, only screaming. Our fathers would want to touch her. I do. I want to put my arm around her and say, I understand. I too am screaming. She continues to scream without taking a breath. It is a lonelier than thou scream, and it's impressive. I find I want to raise my voice. I've read from this book like 35 times, and I have not once remembered to look at my watch before I started reading. You'd think we might figure it out. Let's go. Let me skip to the end of the book. This is the title poem, Seven Star Bird, and it requires a little glossing, probably. A couple people make cameo appearances, and they're fairly obscure unless you're big X-Files fans or in now following Madonna into Kabbalah. The first is there's a reference to Isaac Luria in Palestinian 16th century, sort of the father of modern Kabbalah, of whom very little exists, but who remains sort of a figure. There was actually an X-Files where there was a golem. They called the golem Isaac Luria, which is one of those sort of wonderful moments. You know, those people in Hollywood are a little bit, you know, they're not doing exactly what they want to do, maybe. The other person who makes an appearance is Valentine. Valentine was certainly my favorite of the Gnostic thinkers. It's simply because I find his stuff so beautiful. It's rich for stealing, and I do that. So the last note, I think, is this has an epigraph from Ovid. This is from the beginning of the Metamorphosis when the gods are pissed off at whatever, the stick people or the mud people, I forget which, and decides just to wipe them out. And so here are the gods in Ovid calling on the river horses to flood the place. And God's anger called his rivers all and told them to let the river horses run wild as they ever would. And the leaping rivers flooded the great plains. This is addressed to my son, Doc. I had wanted to write, I'm a big Coleridge fan, and you know the poem Frost at Midnight, maybe. There's this beautiful poem where he's holding Hartley and it's, you know, there's a fire and it's gorgeous. So I wanted to write one of those, and it turns out I didn't, but it is the same sort of sense of addressing a poem to a son, sort of with the hope that, you know, it'll be something that's there for him later. Seven Star Bird. As breezes lap the shallow tugged tide flow, and swallows twitter and skirt the dusk, we lie within the wreckage of the stars, the moon spill, our planets pull, this sad machine. With you sleeping against my chest, having drifted off as Venus began to blaze, I feel my father's heavy breath bear down against my cheek, a finger toward the comet's tail. Like a damn flashlight looking down, he said. For 3 nights we watched it, then that light was out. So we steered by the swirling mathematics of whiskey and revenge, the business of getting, then of letting go. Stars gather in the sky like rain, dizzy atoms that collapse, collide. In our dream, the dead of Friendship, Texas, stand on the shore of their once town singing, let the river horses run, let them run. Once in America, in full nakedness, our family rivered these lands with abandon. From Moravia to Galveston to Friendship, Texas, their wild seeds sown, their hearts full of leaving, they long to stay, abide, abide, reside. But the tide comes to meet us and also to take us away. When the dam was built to swell the rich town south, the flood spilled over. Let the river horses run. Valentinian speculation holds that our souls, as light, are drawn to the waxing moon, which then, upon the wane, delivers its freight to the darker dark beyond. Electrons finally freed into streams of gravity gone wild, while alone in the dust of Palestine, sad Luria watches as God withdraws, and so the world arises. Let the river horses run, let them run. If, as has been said, it is our very love of God that separates us from him, can't we say the names we sketch on the churning atoms of this world's things, while keeping us apart, allow us also to love? Isn't this enough, the shadow that we know a swallow by? The tide flows in, the moon spill. Let's hymn down the river, witness the resting away. If America drew us to a destiny of desire, it was the outfall of a single star stunned, our sweet metals and machines. So return, exile, then return again. Want no more than water does, low places to dwell and the gravity to change. And if you too are lost one day in loss itself, may you trace a bird amid the mess of stars. May you name it as you wish, seven-star bird, lover, God, and may its wandering guide your own. Let the river horses run, let them run. Let them run wild as they ever would. These are brand new poems. Almost none of them I've read aloud, and very few people have seen them. So they're potentially offensive in all sorts of ways, aesthetically, and because they seem sort of rough and unfinished. But I thought this would be a fun occasion to sort of to bring them out. So I hope you'll forgive me. The first one is called Crash. It's a long first section of a much longer poem that sort of is the title poem of the new collection. And let's see, we need to know that, if you don't know or don't remember, that Milton was blind as he was finishing Paradise Lost. And Milton and Blake are sort of friends of mine. They show up a lot in the poems. There's something I haven't quite worked into the poem properly yet, I think. You haven't heard of clawed glasses. In the late 18th and early 19th century, it was a fashion in England to walk around the countryside with these colored mirrors or colored lenses that would act as a frame. So they'd walk around looking for, you know, basically poor people or beautiful scenes to make them picturesque. It's sort of a lovely thing. You can actually, I looked up pictures of these things. It's wonderful. So anyhow, they make an appearance later on. Crash. As a boy, angels appeared at my window. They would open it like a window to my parents dying. The jangling car crash, the spinning, that moment frozen forever, then the next. Such terror and beauty mixed, the angels' hilarity. They crept up the glass like frost. When I asked questions, the angels lied, or they'd fidget like parents talking of sex, or they'd open the window farther, revealing more pain, more spectacle, whole worlds churning in war, in fire, hysterical. It was dizzying. Or else they'd just vanish like fireworks, worms of light in my head, leaving the darkness I knew. Feels bristled and shagged, the Negro church beyond glowing, as it did above the frog pond, silent with the cold. This is a fact. I live between Blake and Milton Streets in Cambridge, Massachusetts, amid, no doubt, a confusion of ecto-activity. Both streets lead nowhere, or rather lead to other streets. Their imperturbable houses hunched like mourners taking a handful of earth from a sextant's shovel. It's laughable, a joke really, the houses' wings tucked close to their sides, the night sirens, the snapping at insects that whirl like planets around the lamppost suns. At 13, talking with my girlfriend on a beige princess phone stretched to my bed, I put a Ruger 22 revolver to my temple and did not pull the trigger, then or ever. Blake says, "It's funny, isn't it, seeing through that hole and not with it?" I say to him, and it's a kind of joke, "These are Milton's eyes." With all eyes closed, I see the red worms always. They turn into faces, Blake's, Milton's, everyone's I've known. There's some madness in this method. Many questions plaguing the late 18th and early 19th centuries have, in our century, found answers in rural Tennessee. The picturesque, a Negro church perched in the red light of a sunset above a frog pond within a field slightly fogged. The beautiful, my motorcycle ripping through that field as a car filled with parents spins off the road into the church and all into flame. The sublime, the church's wings spread, it rockets into the night. Its windows fill with faces of the dead, mouthing all our names. At 20, I fell in love with a dying woman, or else with her dying, I don't know. Nothing had ever been so sad, so vivid. Holding her as she threw up beside her car on Green Hills Avenue, or else making love and then stumbling to Mass. Her name was Laura, the dawn, you know. A joke, it turns out. I begged her to marry me. I wanted what little she had left, wanted to hold it, to eat it, to stuff it down my throat. The angels still torment me for this. They shut the sky around me and say, "Nice work, Keats." I beg them. I was just a child, I say. I thought I loved her. She is an angel now, earth, whatever, a little sun in my head, in many heads, rising. In Paris, near the end, her spleen hard as a melon, we made love like it was the last time, which, and this is funny, it was. Then, drunk and driving through the madness of Paris, I crashed into a parked car, a carnival of sparks, and it was hilarious. We just kept going. Nowhere, it turns out. Blake gave me a souvenir of Claude glasses, a rose-colored mirror for framing our world, that once had belonged to Ginsberg and briefly to Wolfe, Lennon, Cobain, and various others, etc. With them, I wander the fields of houses blossoming across America in search of love or beauty, something. It's hysterical and pointless, of course. So Milton gave me Blake's skull, which I wear over my own, as Milton did, and God. It's hilarious what you see. Look, it's a beautiful fucking joke. Sublime, even. At 9, my son, lovesick, considers death. At 9, obsessed with my parents' death, my parents brought me to a shrink in a green glass brick office in Shreveport, Louisiana. He said, "What if they really did die in a car crash? What then?" "You mean," I said, "they really could die?" 20 years later, another shrink, hearing this, bursts into laughter. Blake, too, and Milton, and all the angels, the whole world, laughing. 30 years later, my son stares, weeping, of course, at a screen of pixels that opens like a window to an evening long ago. This is a poem called Rock and Roll. You may not know, and it's sad that you may not know it, but John Doe and Exene Cervenka, do you know those names? They led the seminal LA punk band X, and they were great, and they were beautiful, and they were in love. So there's a little reference to those two here. Maybe AC/DC is a band you know. There's also a reference here to Dante, and he has a poem, sort of his midlife crisis poem, The Inferno, where he starts off, "Midway in the journey of my life, I found myself lost in the woods." And if you don't remember that, that's maybe relevant here. Rock and roll. Wildly in love, in 1987, Los Angeles, John Doe and Exene Cervenka gather at a microphone and howl, "I'm lost, headed down the highway." In 1980, all over the world, Angus Young of AC/DC shouts its anthemic "Highway to Hell" in reference to Milton's Satan in Paradise Lost, Book 2, as he stands lost, staring into the abyss of chaos and old night, with whom he bargains, etc., etc. Henceforth, and before forth, really, all lost highways lead to hell, and everyone rides them, at least for a while. Willie Loman says, "To be 30 and lost in America, the greatest country in the world, is a disgrace." Of course, it's grace itself that may be the problem, as Willie learns soon enough. If Dante were approaching midlife today, lost, one wonders if he'd simply buy a car and, heading down the highway, blast classic rock. Many of the lost buy Porsches, if they can. The fired-up descendant of Hitler's vision of the people's car, the Volkswagen Beetle, engineered by Ferdinand Porsche himself, based on Hitler's sketch. The quintessential car of the summer of love, driven by Dean Stockwell, close friend of Neil Young, in The Love Bug. Dean, a beautiful American by all accounts, was a junkie and very lost. In 1994, Kurt Cobain of Nirvana could rock with the best of them and was a terrible disgrace. A guitar is like a gun, is like a cock, is like a mic. Simple stuff, says Dr. Freud, whose mouth in the end looked like Kurt's after he, very lost, stuffed a mic down his throat, growled a few beautiful growls, and pulled the trigger. Funny set, right? Can't get out of that. I'll just read one more. This one is called The Sonnet. God, I love sonnets. I think of them every day. just as I think of my father, who was, in fact, a sonneteer. He wandered 12th century France or Italy, wherever, grief fogged such things, his huge head full of song. God, I miss him. But he clearly wasn't meant for war. They say he stood up in the trenches to recite poems in the enemy's direction. Love, you know, love. Then the red laser sight light found his forehead, reminding his commander for a moment of a beautiful Hindi woman he wished to love. Bang, bang. Sometimes love is like that. Just as you reach for it, it runs away, or else it puts a bullet in your head. This may, of course, be the wrong kind of love. Sonnets are as mathematical as music, as elegant and sensible as the universe, and God, I love music. It was, I think, Pythagoras who, in the birthplace of democracy, sort of, hearing the harmonies of a blacksmith's hammer, determined that pleasurable resonance grew from metal slabs bearing precise fractional relations, and thus, for the first and only time in history, discovered a physical truth of an abstract notion. Despite many attempts, despite even the mighty sonnet, love remains adrift. Anyhow, sonnets, like the universe, are ruled by just six numbers. Metaphors, really. Galaxies spin according to them, neutrinos blink and whirl, matter collapses, they suckle us in some stellar nursery, deliver gravity to break our hearts, hearts filled with love, love and blood, the better kind of love. I know it would have been clever if this had been a sonnet, a double sonnet or some such. Yes, well, I'll leave that to my sons, who miss me already. They're very busy mapping out our future in the glowing digital domain. There will be conquests and certainty, end stops. And it won't be long now. They have the tools. They have the proofs. Thank you.